Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. In this episode, we're joined by Sebastian Ruder. Sebastian is a PhD student studying natural language processing at the National University of Ireland and a research scientist at text analysis startup Alien. In our conversation, Sebastian and I discuss recent milestones in neural NLP, including multitask learning and pre-trained language models. We also discuss the use of attention-based models, tree RNNs and LSTMs, and memory-based networks. Finally, Sebastian walks us through his recent UML FIT paper, short for Universal Language Model Fine-Tuning for Text Classification, which he co-authored with Jeremy Howard of Fast.ai, who I interviewed in episode 186. Before we dive into the conversation, I'd like to send a huge thanks to our friends at IBM for their sponsorship of this show. Interested in exploring code patterns leveraging multiple technologies, including ML and AI? Then check out IBM Developer. With more than 100 open source programs, a library of knowledge resources, developer advocates ready to help, and a global community of developers, what in the world will you create? Dive in at ibm.biz/mlaipodcast and be sure to let them know that Twimmel sent you. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am on the line with Sebastian Ruder. Sebastian is a PhD student studying natural language processing at the National University of Ireland, as well as a research scientist at Alien. Sebastian, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited about having you on the show. We've been trying to coordinate this for a while, and so thank you once again. Now, you've been doing some really interesting work at kind of the intersection of deep learning and natural language processing that I'm looking forward to diving into. But before we do that, I'd love to learn a bit about your background. You've been studying natural language processing and computational linguistics in particular since undergrad days. How did you get interested and into this field of study?
So as you said, I did my undergrad in computational linguistics at the University of Heidelberg in Germany. And computational linguistics really is still quite a small field, or at least when I was studying that, there wasn't that much interest in it. And so how I initially got into that was that I was during high school really interested in both mathematics and languages as well. So I really liked kind of learning different languages. But at the same time, kind of the analytical side of math really appealed to me. And so I really was looking for something that, fields that where I could manage to combine both those maybe quite different areas. And then in doing research, I really found that, computational linguistics was really the field which is really at the intersection of, computer science and linguistics. And so for me, I tried that out and really seemed to be the perfect fit for me personally. And a lot of the kind of my classmates at that time, what I really liked about computational linguistics was that it seemed to, because you kind of need such a peculiar set of interests. So there were a lot of people in that subject with like a variety of different interests. People who were interested in kind of other things, social sciences, psycholinguistics as well. So we really had kind of a very wide variety, broad set of backgrounds. And I think that made studying and working in the field particularly interesting for me as well.
Tell us a little bit about your graduate work.
So I did kind of the undergrad in that there, and then afterwards I was really looking for I really wanted to stay in the field as well, but I was looking for to get some industry experience first. But then in kind of researching for a job, I came across a program, kind of an industrial PhD program, where you could combine research and kind of industry work as well, and that really appealed to me. And I decided to go in that direction consequently. And then doing my graduate work, I was really looking for something Initially, I started working on kind of a lot of the applications of NLP. So as it's often used in the industry setting, like working on different applications of text classification, like sentiment analysis or different forms of information extraction. And then kind of working on those very downstream tasks, I realized that actually the most kind of the challenge that permeated those, or what was really at the heart of solving them, was really because we had to create text classification applications for a lot of different domains, different languages, different data from different customers as well. So I really realized that in order to solve those challenges better, we actually need to have better methods and better algorithms to learn from limited amounts of label data. So really having either models that analyze better or better ways to learn from either distant or distant supervision or from unlabeled data too. So this kind of idea of how can we more efficiently either use labeled data or how can we learn from additional sources of supervision has really driven a lot of my interest and really a lot of my graduate work.
And you're finishing up your PhD kind of any day now, right? You're on your last year?
Yeah, I'm in my last year, so I'm currently in the process of just writing up my thesis and putting those different projects on which I worked on together, essentially.
And I guess the last background question, you are also working as a research scientist at Alien, which it sounds like is through this industrial PhD program?
Yeah, exactly.
And what does Alien do?
So Alien is focused, a natural language processing startup, which is mainly focused on analyzing and providing services around news. So we have some kind of a different number of products, one which aims at aggregating news and enriching news with different forms of kind of semantic information like entities, but also relations, and sentiment, so doing things like named entity recognition, entity linking, sentiment analysis around those. And then there's kind of a separate set of services which developers can integrate into their own applications to kind of use NLP in their own services. And then finally, we also do a fair amount of consulting, so developing kind of specialized applications for particular customers.
Okay, very cool. And so maybe to kind of dive into some of your work in NLP, you recently wrote, I think, on your blog, a post about kind of the history of natural language processing from your perspective. Maybe kind of walk us through maybe not the full history, but kind of the interesting recent historical developments in the field.
Sure. Yeah. So that blog post kind of arose in conjunction or as a byproduct of a session on natural language processing that we organized at the Deep Learning Indaba, which is kind of a big initiative, kind of a summer school-like event in South Africa that kind of sought to bring together and strengthen the African machine learning community. And for a session on natural language processing, we essentially wanted to give kind of both beginners as well as maybe people who've already worked with NLP an overview of maybe some of the most important milestones that are still relevant today, or that they can still, like knowing them would still kind of help them tackle ongoing challenges. And in compiling this kind of this overview, Herman Camper, who co-organized the session with me, we essentially started out because we really wanted to have to get something that not only reflects our opinion, but also some opinions of a larger set of experts. We started out just sending emails to a number of experts in NLP just to get a bit more more suggestions and more ideas. And then essentially we compiled kind of the 8 milestones that were mentioned and then we found relevant into a list here. And so just because the main kind of category of methods that are currently being used in NLP at this point are really mostly using neural network-based approaches. So because of that, we mainly focused on kind of approaches or milestones that have relevance to that. Although in the post, there's also a lot of other kind of more traditional milestones that led up to that research, and which kind of a lot of research later on is building on. So to cut things short, essentially the milestones we arrived at were kind of the first neural language models that were proposed in 2001, kind of as a something that has been in many different ways kind of built upon and or co-opted by subsequent approaches, because a lot of different tasks like sequence-to-sequence learning or even learning word embeddings can be expressed as some sort of variation of just doing language modeling. Then something that is becoming more prevalent these days is multitask learning, which was first proposed for NLP in 2008 as kind of a very milestone, very seminal paper of Kohlberg and Westman. And that paper also got the Test of Time Award at ICML this year.
What's that paper called?
So it's like a unified architecture of for natural language processing, I think. Deep neural networks with multitask learning. I think that's the full title. So that's definitely, if you haven't read that paper yet, that's really worth reading.
And I'm surprised to hear that one was 10 years ago. Multitask learning seems to be just getting popular. I should say I'm reading a lot more about it over the past, maybe 6 to 9 months.
So in that paper in particular, that introduced kind of a lot of different techniques, like using CNNs for text, for instance, or even using something like unsupervised learning of word embeddings. That was in 2008. And only about 5 years later, people were really starting to use word embeddings. And even nowadays, so now like 10 years later, people are actually really starting to pick up multitask learning. So in many ways, that particular paper was kind of a bit ahead of its time and not really widely kind of regarded, or not a lot of people kind of took inspiration from that paper at that time. And then kind of probably what most of the experts we were talking to mentioned really as one of the biggest recent milestones was the use of word embeddings that were pre-trained and learned in an unsupervised way on a large corpus. So that really started out with Word2Vec. Mm-hmm. And kind of a whole separate branch of research that had kicked off of really trying to better understand what these word embeddings capture. And word embeddings really are still very widely used. Even Word2Vec is still often used in papers these days. And then kind of the last milestones we mentioned were essentially just the more prevalent use of using neural networks for NLP, and mainly then kind of in three different types. So essentially, the main types people are using these days are recurrent neural networks, and mainly these long short-term memory networks, which are kind of a modification on this classic recurrent neural network. Then convolutional neural networks have been proposed for NLP and also used in particular for particularly for some text classification tasks like sentiment analysis. They have been used quite often, and now more recently also for different tasks like machine translation, for instance, because people have realized that using these convolutions you can actually capture more efficiently long-term dependencies in your data by using kind of wider receptive fields with dilated convolutions in your models. So there have been some recent CNN-based models for machine translation. And then one particular category that I find quite interesting in NLP is that you have, because linguistically, if you look at a sentence, a sentence can be kind of split up hierarchically. So you have words, or even like going on the subword level, you have different morphemes that compose into a word, and then you have words that form different clauses or chunks in a sentence. So instead of processing a sentence sequentially, you can have models that take as input or act upon this tree structure as well. And these have been kind of called historically like recursive neural networks, because they kind of recursively from the bottom up, so starting from the individual words, build the representation of the entire sentence using some sort of composition function. And more recently, they're also called tree RNNs or tree LSTMs. So you can have an LSTM that doesn't act on a sequence, but on an entire tree.
how much are those used, and you know, how well do they work?
Yeah, so it really depends on the kind of tasks you use. So they can be kind of useful if you want to, for instance, incorporate. So for machine translation, some of these some modifications using these kind of tree-based methods have been proposed, essentially to incorporate a bit more syntactic structure into the model. So just to make it a bit easier for the model to model this type of structure, which helps when translating into certain languages, or maybe if you translate from one language where, for instance, the verb comes, so where the object comes first, to a language where this where the position of object is reversed, for instance. So in some sense, this can help you model some syntactic relations. And or another task, like for sentiment, there's been some data sets where you can have kind of supervision at the word level, where these for which task these have been originally proposed. So there have been a few things in general. Still, if you have like an arbitrary NLP task, probably like a bidirectional LSTM will still get you further, probably. But I would guess, or I really hope to see, I personally would hope to see more of these models that can actually incorporate some linguistic information in kind of as a future direction. Mm-hmm. So I think this, maybe while it's maybe not the most performant model yet, I think it's really a kind of useful way or useful kind of method or kind of class of methods to think about. Yeah. And more recently, you can have people have started using kind of graph convolutional networks, which basically apply like a CNN, the convolution operation on this tree as well. And they've shown some good results for tasks where you have some dependencies like semantic row labeling, for instance.
Like semantic what?
Like semantic row labeling.
Row labeling?
Which is kind of a classic NLP task, and basically a form of, so it's also, people also refer to it as shallow semantic parsing. And it essentially, comes kind of from has like an underlying theory in that you have different frames of sentences. So depending what verbs you use, each verb would evoke a different frame. And then you would essentially try to label the arguments of that verb that co-occur with that frame. So it's kind of a more linguistically informed or classic linguistic task that people have been evaluating on.
The next milestone that you pick up is sequence-to-sequence models, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Those have been popping up all over the place, not just NLP.
So it's really kind of, in doing that review, I looked back at the paper again, and they, in their paper, I think mainly evaluated on machine translation, which is, I think, really the kind of the biggest application these kinds of models have been applied to. But for context, sequence-to-sequence models are essentially just a general kind of framework that tries to map an input sequence, so it can be words, but can also be any other type of symbols, to an output sequence using an encoder neural network that encodes this input sequence into a fixed-size vector, and then output sequence that, given that vector, generates the target sequence. And this has originally been proposed in 2015 for machine translation. But since then, basically, a lot of applications in NLP, like as soon as you try to generate a sentence, most of these models would try to use kind of a sequence-to-sequence model under the hood. Yeah, so these have been very popular for things like chatbots, or even in settings where you don't have an input sequence as your input, but just kind of another representation. Like for image captioning, for instance, you can imagine that you have a CNN model that generates a representation of an image, and then based on that, you would use that as initialization for your LSTM, and you would then try to generate the caption of that image. So this framework has really turned out to be very versatile and really applicable in a lot of scenarios.
You also mentioned attention-based methods. How do those fit into NLP?
Attention, probably like everyone who's kind of aware of sequence-to-sequence model probably has also heard of attention. So attention was kind of is the probably the main improvement that has really allowed machine translation models to exceed and overcome or outperform classic phrase-based or statistical machine translation models. And attention really, so as I mentioned before, in classic sequence-to-sequence learning, you would try to have a model that compresses the input sequence into a fixed size vector. But that, if you can imagine for machine translation, if you have a very long sentence or even entire paragraph that you might want to translate to, it can be very challenging, or it can place a lot of computational burden on the model to try to compress the entire meaning of this paragraph into a fixed size vector. And attention essentially allows the model to kind of overcome this bottleneck. So in addition to having this fixed size vector, at every step of generating an output symbol, the model can also look back at kind of the input sequence and at the different hidden states of the input sequence. And essentially, it allows the model to, instead of having to compress everything into one state, essentially remember kind of the most similar past states, which then makes it easier for the model to generate the relevant output. And and attention also is really something that has turned out to be quite flexible. So that is really now used, I think, in most sequence-to-sequence learning tasks as well, but has also been used in, for instance, in image captioning. So you could imagine that instead of kind of paying attention to different parts of your input sequence, when you just try to generate a caption or individual words based on image, you can also pay particular attention to certain parts of that image that might be relevant for generating that next word. Generally, so I think that nowadays it's really common attention, because this idea of just computing kind of a weight or kind of a weighted average of your input sequence or of certain states based on the similarity, so the dot product to your current state, really has allowed kind of models that can access memory based on similarity to kind of the current state, or also these recent basically kind of state-of-the-art models for machine translation, which is a transformer, which essentially uses self-attention. So basically attention not applied to a previous sequence, but to the sequence itself, to essentially allow the model to kind of look at and consider the surrounding words and the surrounding context to improve the representation of the current word. And by using multiple layers, this can be done multiple times, so that you can have a kind of a more contextually sensitive and a hopefully more expressive or better representation of each word in your sentence.
Is this related at all to the representations of networks like WaveNet, where you've got like these hierarchical layers that are folding upwards? And does that concept relate to WaveNet, for example?
Yeah, so basically in kind of these convolutional sequence models, you can model like kind of longer dependencies between different words by essentially stacking these convolutional layers on top of each other. Yeah? So as you go higher, each word will be able to kind of access or consider kind of words that have been come come earlier in the sentence. Yeah. So with just a few layers, if you use dilated convolutions, you can have you're able to incorporate almost the entire sequence length. And with attention, essentially, you can do that instead. You don't need to stack layers at all, because the attention mask or this attention operation allows you to directly look at all of the words in the sentence. So essentially, you kind of have this, you have like a global context essentially at every layer, whereas in this convolutional one, at every layer, you have a local context, but which can very quickly scale to a global context. So an attention layer intuitively kind of makes it easier to model this global context. But on the other hand, you miss out on some of this local information again, because your mask or your attention operation is kind of irrespective of the of the position of the words. So because of that, people typically use kind of an embedding of the position or some function that indicates where the word in a sentence is situated to be able to kind of model this local context again.
When you describe attention, you're talking about this attention mask, which essentially kind of weights where you're looking at in the input vectors. Is that the right way to think about it?
Exactly. So you generally have some attention weights that you compute, and then you do softmax over that. So in the end, you get some kind of a probability distribution that tells you how relevant each of the words is or how similar they are to your current input. And then in attention, the way these attention weights are computed, that can differ a bit, and that usually includes a number of learned parameters so that model can kind of learn to pay attention or with regard to different aspects potentially.
And so the next milestone on your list are memory-based networks, and that's not a term that I've heard used. What is that referring to?
We use that to refer to basically kind of a variety of different methods that essentially have some sort of memory mechanism. Yeah. So essentially, these methods are kind of very similar to attention in a way, in that you can kind of see attention as essentially using the past hidden states of your model essentially as a memory or like a lookup table. So by using attention, your model essentially has like a memory that is the size of the input sequence. And these other methods are similar in a way, but some of them have kind of in addition not only that you're able to read from this memory, but you can also write back at the memory. So DeepMind, they have, or researchers from DeepMind probably have produced most of these models that fall under this category, with some coming from FAIR as well. And probably one of the most common ones is kind of this neural Turing machine, which essentially tries to mimic kind of the classic Turing machine, which has like this tape where you can read and write to, and which essentially tries to use this concept and implement that in a neural network by having a memory where you can basically read and write to as well, with a mechanism that is very similar to kind of attention, that you can basically access content based on similarity, but you can also have some location-based addressing, in that you kind of know, okay, you've stored this information in a certain part of your memory, so you can access that based on location as well. And these types of models really are kind of, I found it kind of useful to include this particular category of models, because I think this concept of memory is kind of closely tied to attention, but also because I think going forward, having some sort of memory or some sort of additional capacity of the model to access additional information in some form of, or another. So for instance, having access in some way to a knowledge base that you can kind of query from or write to as well, or having some kind of more expressive way of storing, remembering, like reading, storing facts that you've read about, and then recalling them. I think going forward and really to really. I think we can probably talk about that later in more depth as well. But really, to kind of have models that can kind of reason and have better reasoning abilities, we need some sort of some sort of memory or something, some mechanism that comes at least close to that.
It does seem a bit like the previous milestones that you've mentioned. The impacts of those are fairly clear. With these memory-based networks, it's a bit more speculative. Do you feel that way?
I definitely agree with that. So most of these methods have either been evaluated on either kind of synthetic tasks, like counting, sorting, things like that, or on so kind of the baby data set from Facebook AI research, which is essentially a synthetically generated data set for reading comprehension. So essentially they generate kind of stories which consist of different sentences, which involve multiple actors and kind of objects, such as people moving a ball or bringing the ball to different rooms. And in the end, the question would be, okay, where's the ball? And yeah, so most of these methods have been incorporated on this data set, which is quite synthetic in the way it was created. So, and in practice, people haven't really seen them scale too well to kind of more realistic data sets. So I think it's really safe to say that so far kind of the impact was probably limited. But I think kind of this, this mechanism, I think, is promising for the future.
And so that brings us to 2018, the last milestone on your list, which is pre-trained language models and more generally the idea of being able to apply transfer learning, which we've seen a ton of success with in the image domain, to NLP. And you've done quite a bit in that space. You know, tell us about what you've seen in that space that kind of inspired you to start working in that area.
So for me personally, so maybe I came on that from two directions. So first, in my personal research, as I've worked on different tasks and kind of developing different like domain annotation, multi-task learning methods for different tasks that were like usually task-specific and try to incorporate some features of the target task. Kind of the logical or kind of the natural progression in that was really trying to work on kind of this more general inductive transfer learning setting, essentially, where you try to use some sort of pre-trained knowledge and generalize or use that to do better on an arbitrary target task, essentially. So in that context, you really want to have some pre-training task or some existing information that is as general as possible so that it will be likely useful for kind of any number of target tasks, essentially. And then in the second direction, I've also been really following a lot of the progress made in computer vision. And I've just really been fascinated I found it really cool to see that how transfer learning was really kind of commonplace there and really used a lot in practice and by practitioners in computer vision. That was really very easy to build models or to just collect a few hundred images for different classes that you care about, use a pre-trained model, fine-tune those on those images, and you could really already get reasonable performance. And I found that really kind of a factor that I think made it easy for a lot of people to just experiment or develop their own computer vision models. And I really wanted to have something thought it would be very useful to have something similar for natural language as well, where you can similarly collect a few hundred label examples and train your own models for your own tasks that you care about. And kind of in thinking about that, I started kind of talking with Jeremy Howard from Fast AI as well, who's been thinking along similar directions. And concurrently, there's been related work coming out from the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence as well. And so it really started to crystallize that the ideal or a useful pre-training task for that would really be language modeling, because that's already been used as a as a successful variant with Word2Vec, because all Word2Vec does is essentially kind of a variation of language modeling. But instead of using that just to initialize the first layer of our models with word embeddings, why don't we just pre-train a language model and use that to initialize the remaining parameters of our models? And that really kind of was... This overall direction wasn't completely new. So in 2015, there was the first paper which actually used language models and fine-tuned those on the target task. And we essentially kind of took that a step further, added a step where we pre-trained that on a general domain corpus and then proposed some other techniques to improve the fine-tuning performance or to to retain as much information as possible during this fine-tuning process.
I guess when we're talking about transfer learning, there's two pieces. One is being able to use models that are created by third parties, presumably on other data sets. And the other element is this ability to kind of fine tune it to meet your specific needs. With kind of that in mind, like, do you consider word embeddings to be transfer learning? You know, certainly we share like glove vectors and things like that. They definitely meet that first criteria, but maybe not the second. Is that the key distinction that you make?
So I definitely think using like pre-trained word embeddings is one form of transfer learning. Yeah, so it's one way or kind of a very simple way to use existing pre-trained knowledge. Yeah, and kind of using pre-trained language models in the asset is really kind of an additional step. Or you basically use kind of that knowledge and for additional input in your model, either to initialize more layers, or you use kind of these richer these embeddings from language models, which just capture richer relations than you could capture with word embeddings. So both are kind of forms of transfer learning, but I think using language models goes kind of a step further than just using word embeddings.
When you say language models, what specifically are you referring to? When I think of language models, I think of things like LDA. Is that what you're referring to, or are you speaking about them more broadly?
So LDA, so latent Dirichlet allocation, is an example of topic modeling. Yeah? So topic modeling is typically just used for like data exploration, where you have like a corpus and you want to find out what people are talking about in there. Yeah? So that generally gives you like a list of topics. So language modeling, when people talk about language modeling, language modeling really is the task of you have a sequence of words, like a sentence, and you want to predict the next word in that sequence. So it's a very clearly defined task, yeah, and it's because you only need kind of the raw text data, essentially. So given the text, you always know what the next word is that you want to predict. So you can very easily train this kind of model on large amounts of data.
The typical approach to solving this kind of task would be like an LSTM.
So the typical model really these days, so the more traditional model, so stepping back a bit, the more traditional model would be kind of using, basically using n-grams, so using kind of different windows of words, and then computing the next word or predicting the next word based on what words you've seen co-occur with your existing n-grams, essentially. And then these days, you have kind of a typical language model would be an LSTM, maybe with multiple layers. So that would kind of be the most typical one. People have used other models as well, using memory or kind of other variations on this classic LSTM. But recently, actually, people showed that if you're just a bit more careful about tuning the hyperparameters of your LSTM, you can actually get very good performance just using a classic LSTM for language modeling.
And so the method that you came up with Jeremy is called ULM Fit. Tell us a little bit about, how it works and the approach you took there.
Sure. So our intuition was really with that method that instead of initializing only the first layer of the model with word embeddings, we really want to have something with which we can initialize our entire model so that we, in the end, can take our pre-trained language model and we just need to put a new layer, like a new layer for the classification task on top. And essentially, our kind of method we propose here consists of three steps. So we first just train kind of a classic LSTM language model on a large general domain corpus. So we really want to have a kind of a corpus that can capture very general domain knowledge. And for that, we just used kind of a corpus, a subset of Wikipedia that is quite commonly used for language model evaluation and training as well. And then in the second step, you want to get this language model to kind of learn about some of the characteristics of the data or of the corpus you actually care about. So in that second step, we then fine-tune this language model. So still the same language model, only we can just continue training it on data of our new classification tasks. So for instance, if we want to do a movie review classification based on positive or negative reviews, we would just fine tune that and continue training it on movie reviews of that domain. And for that step, essentially, we realized that we don't really want to train the model, like use too high of learning rate, or you want to kind of be careful in how you train the model so that you don't actually accidentally overwrite the information that your general language model has already captured before. So we essentially proposed kind of two different techniques, a certain learning rate schedule, and using different learning rates for different layers, essentially for the model to allow to retain as much of the general information from the general language model as possible, and kind of only adapt the higher layers of the model for the new domain. Because our intuition was with that from computer vision, people have shown that essentially the lowest layers of the model really capture the most general information. So in the lowest layers, you really have information about the edges and kind of very general features. And as you go higher, the information gets more specific to the task. For ImageNet, you would have the higher layers really responding to particular parts of dogs or dog noses even. So the information as you go higher in the model gets more task specific. And in NLP, people actually now recently have started to show that there's like a similar hierarchy of information in a neural model that was trained on text. So because of that, our intuition was really that we want to retain as much of the information in the lower layers as possible, and then use higher learning rates for the higher layers to adapt them to a larger extent. And then in the final step, we essentially remove the softmax layer that was used for the language modeling objective and replace that with a layer, so just softmax cross-entropy layer that just tries to predict the target classes for our task. And we just train that new layer on top of together with the remaining language model. And here, in addition to the two previous techniques, we also propose to make it a bit easier for the model to adapt the top layer to the which is randomly initialized to the other parameters which have already been trained. So we initially only train the top layer and freeze the remaining layers, and then at each subsequent epoch unfreeze another layer from the top down to make it kind of easier for the model to adapt the new parameters to the ones, to the existing ones that have already been trained.
Well, there's a lot there. So first, let's maybe start by noting that the method is specifically kind of targeting a classification type of a task, as opposed to, you know, predicting the next word or a generation type of task. Where do you see those classification tasks come up?
So we decided to initially focus on classification just because we thought that was kind of the most, or those had like the most real world applications. A lot of applications from classifying jet logs, customer requests in different categories, routing those to relevant entities, in legal, classifying different legal documents depending on different fields. So I think classification is really something as soon as you have some sort of text that is generated and you want to have some information that you want to filter out, that can be expressed as a classification task if you just are able just to define a certain number of categories that you want to express. Or similarly, a lot of other tasks, like even doing sequence labeling or so, can also be expressed as classification. So we found that by focusing on classification first, we can really cover a lot of the real-world applications of NLP.
And then you mentioned that recent research has shown that in neural networks that are kind of language models, there's a similar phenomenon to what we've seen in computer vision, where the lower layers are more general. On the computer vision side, we've got some intuitive ways of explaining that and talking about low-level features like edges and textures and things like that as being found in these lower layers. Is there a similar clean way to explain what we're seeing in the NLP side?
So in computer vision, it's always nice that you can actually get some sort of like intuitive feeling by visualizing that. In NLP, it's not exactly as straightforward. But it's still somewhat intuitive. So far, I think there's been kind of two ways in which people have shown that there's like some hierarchy. First, when you do multitask learning with different NLP tasks. So multitask learning is when you have one model that performs multiple tasks at the same time. And then if you have your model, if you train a model with some kind of higher level or more semantic task, like named entity recognition, and if you train that together with another task that is more syntactic, so kind of a more lower level linguistically, like a part of speech tagging, then people have shown that actually information that is relevant for the part of speech tagging task, so information that kind of maximize the performance on that task is actually captured at lower layers of the model, whereas for named entity recognition, the information would be contained in a higher level layer. And then more recently, in this some papers from AI2, where they had in their ELMO paper and then in a follow up paper as well, they showed that in having these embeddings that were pre-trained or trained in a language model, if you use lower level layers of your model, then those actually give you the best performance for lower level tasks, like part of speech tagging. Whereas for higher level tasks, the best information is contained in higher layers of the model. So far, really the best ways to look at kind of a downstream task that encodes some sort of some level of hierarchy and then basically generalize from that. So far we haven't really, there has not been a kind of more intuitive or like a more easily accessible way by just defining a task that kind of encodes some assumption or something that you want to measure and then measure the performance of different layers of the model on that task.
And then you mentioned that the ULM fit method includes some specific guidance around like setting your learning rates and learning rate scheduling and things like this. On the computer vision side, these types of things are often done very iteratively via experimentation to determine, you know, what the right learning rates are and how to schedule your learning rates or apply learning rates to different layers. Is what you're saying here that you can be more prescriptive about it because of some characteristic of the problem, or just that you should take that kind of an approach when training these models?
So we try to come up with a, so I mean, the way we arrived at these methods were also based on experimentation and trial and error on kind of our validation data as well. But we essentially, or kind of the parameters we arrived at, we found them to perform well on different or kind of a variety of text classification problems. So it's really kind of more of a guidance of, okay, these are like good kind of rules of thumb or like a good range of parameters that give good results in general. But then obviously for particular domains or particular tasks, it might still be useful to do some fine tuning of these parameters or to slightly change them and see particularly playing around with like the learning rate and kind of the number of epochs you train your model can still give you a boost in performance.
And so what kind of results have you seen with this approach?
With our approach that we proposed, we essentially were able to outperform the state of the art on kind of a number of widely studied text classification data sets. And that was particularly kind of exciting, encouraging for us, because on a lot of these data sets, some of the architectures had either a lot of feature or architecture engineering, whereas we really used a very simple LSTM with just different numbers of dropouts and only this kind of pre-training step, essentially. So it was really encouraging that this very simple model was really able to outperform the state of the art on a variety of benchmarks. And then I think to me personally, very exciting was just to see that this type of approach even trained on a limited number of examples. So we basically did some ablation studies where we trained it on smaller training set sizes going from 100 to in different steps to 1,000, 10,000 number of examples. And we really saw that just by virtue of using this pre-trained information and pre-trained language model, we were actually really able to outperform kind of training a model from scratch on the same number of examples by an order of magnitude, or we were able to reach the same performance as a model that was trained from scratch on kind of an order of magnitude more data. And I think this particular finding, and that's something that not only we, but kind of other researchers working in kind of a similar direction of using language modeling have found. And yeah, for me personally, I think that's very encouraging because I think this will really help to unlock a lot of the kind of potential for NLP and just make it easier for people to use it on their own data sets and just should make it easier for people to just collect a small number of examples and then train and apply these kind of models to their data.
Are there any qualitative comparisons you can make between transfer learning in computer vision and transfer learning in NLP based on this approach?
So I think maybe one comparison is that what we initially tried and what is kind of commonly done in computer vision is that you kind of freeze your entire network and you only train like the topmost layer from scratch, or you only unfreeze like a couple of the top layers of the model. But really for us in at least at the moment, because the models people are using right now are still quite a bit more shallow than kind of typical models like ResNet or DenseNet that you would use for transfer learning computer vision. So we really still found it useful to kind of train the entire model or to fine-tune the entire model. At the same time, we've seen, or in the community, kind of one of the most promising approaches is this ELMO approach from AI2. And they actually use or take kind of an orthogonal approach where they don't fine-tune the model, but use the embeddings from the language model kind of as fixed features in a separate model that is still trained from scratch. So you kind of have your existing architecture, and you just add the embedding that you get from your language model for each word as an additional feature as input. And they were able to achieve kind of very good and state-of-the-art performance on a large variety of tasks as well. And kind of recently comparing, so in some ongoing work comparing against the ELMO, we actually find that they're very kind of those. So our fine-tuning approach versus just using the fixed features like an ELMO is quite, achieves about like a similar performance. Whereas in computer vision, really the kind of the prevalent or the current paradigm really seems that people are just fine-tuning these models instead of using them as fixed features. So I think it's still, that's an ongoing research direction, essentially, to see what is kind of the best way going forward, really, to do this sort of fine-tuning in NLP. Do we want to use fine-tuning, or do we want to use fixed features, or maybe a combination of the two? And what are actually, what are like the pros and cons of that?
And in your work, did you train from scratch your pre-trained language model that you then use later on to apply to different tasks, or did you was that already available for you?
So we trained on language model from scratch. So we trained, we tried or experimented with different ways to train the initial language model as well. Just because we wanted to observe the effect of the data on the language model. But there's like different types of tasks. So we trained on this subset of Wikipedia, but ELMO, for instance, was trained on kind of a larger news corpus. And they used, I think, like a pre-trained language model that was available online. And more recently, there's been some work from OpenAI, where they also trained a language model that was based on this transformer architecture from machine translation on an even larger corpus. And it's still not entirely clear how those different, what the actual impact or how much of a benefit it gives you when training on like a larger corpus. I think one hypothesis might be that training a more expressive model on more data, as we've kind of seen over the history of deep learning, that might work better in the long term. But we still need to kind of figure out what actually the best ways to do that.
And out of curiosity, what kind of order of magnitude were you experiencing in terms of training time for these models?
So in terms of training the first language model on the large corpus, or fine-tuning the language model, or
well, both.
So it kind of depends on your on the approach. So when we trained our language model, because the initial this pre-training step, because you have a lot of tokens, a large corpus that you train on, that's usually the most expensive step. So for us, in our early experiments, we trained that about for 24 hours on one GPU, essentially. And then usually the fine tuning and the final training set would be a lot faster. So maybe it would be 1 hour, depending on the training set size. In their OpenAI paper, because they trained an even larger model on even more data, they trained for about a month. So you can really, if you scale that up, that can take a lot longer. But then fine tuning would probably take similarly long, maybe a bit longer because the model is steeper. And recently, in the FastAI library, with some ongoing experience from computer vision, they've integrated some methods where you can train, which are there's one technique called super convergence that has shown some good results for computer vision, where you essentially have a particular learning rate schedule and you train your model with a very high learning rate. And in doing that, and if you're careful about how you use the schedule, you can get to very high performance very fast. So using a technique like that might also, for language modeling, might also allow you to train your language models significantly faster.
With word embeddings, we've those have matured and we've gotten to the point that there are, multiple options for word embedding vectors that you can more or less use interchangeably. Is that the case for these pre-trained language models? Can you use either the OpenAI language models or what you've published interchangeably in building out models and just experiment to see what works best for you? Or are the language models more, intertwined to how they are intended to be used?
So in a sense, you can still, you can basically use them interchangeably at this point. Although, we've recently seen, or there's been a recent paper which showed, there's maybe some differences in the representation that these models learn, so that on some tasks, actually having using an LSTM in contrast to a transformer as a language model might actually give you better performance. But then you have the transformer, which might be maybe more efficient than the LSTM because it doesn't require this temporal dependency. But this is, again, still very preliminary work. I don't think at this point we really have a great understanding yet for which type of tasks these particular models work really well. But I think what you want, as long as you have a model, a language model that is very expressive, that achieves a good performance on your data, then I think generally you would probably expect to get similar performance. And then probably going forward, there might be some particular guidance on maybe if you have a sort of reasoning task or something which requires maybe more long-term dependencies, maybe you would rather want to use a transformer. But that's still a bit early stage to give these more concrete rules of them.
Have we covered all there is to cover on ULM fit? What's next in that research direction?
I think in that research direction, I think there's a lot of interesting directions. So first, I don't think we've yet come to the ceiling of what we can achieve using language models in NLP. So I think, I personally think that because of the results we've seen so far are really encouraging and really significant improvements of what we've seen before, people are going to start using more and more, instead of using pre-trained word embeddings, using pre-trained language models in their own applications. So I think these will really become a mainstay in NLP going forward, at least for the foreseeable future. And in that, I think there's still a lot of questions on how you actually how you can kind of compress and capture as much information in your language model as before as possible. What are like the best language models to use? How you can incorporate data in that? So just maximizing the benefit from using this language modeling task, I think, is kind of a near-term direction that will still or should still give us some boosts in some tasks. And then probably in the more long term, and then kind of maybe tied to the former. Just understanding what actually this or how far we can actually go using these language models, because language modeling might, while it gives us a boost on some tasks, it's still a similar objective to what we've been doing with Word2Vec. And just kind of this idea of language modeling, of just predicting the next word based on its previous words, is while it should give you kind of some, should capture some relations in text, there's still a lot of things that it can't capture. So it's, for instance, it's really hard to capture kind of more like real world knowledge actually about how the world works or how different kind of entities or things in the real world kind of relate to each other. Is really hard. It's often not mentioned in text, and then only like very rarely. So it's really hard to capture something like that, which would be really useful for tasks like question answering or reading comprehension with just using language model. So I think one really interesting direction going forward is really how we can incorporate information that allows us to do better sorts of reasoning and natural language understanding, either in order to augment our language model or as additional forms of pre-training, maybe, or maybe additional forms of knowledge as like in a memory from a knowledge base or through some other module that we can then use or leverage in our downstream tasks.
Well, Sebastian, thanks so much for taking the time to chat about this. It's really interesting work you're doing, and I'm looking forward to kind of keeping up with how it evolves.
Cool. Great. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right, everyone, that's our show for today. For more information on Sebastian or any of the topics covered in this episode, visit twimlai.com/talk/195. If you're a fan of the show and you haven't already done so, or you're a new listener and you like what you hear, please head over to your Apple or Google Podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating and review. Your reviews help inspire us to create more and better content, and they help new listeners find the show. Thanks again to our friends at IBM for their sponsorship of this episode. Be sure to check out IBM Developer at ibm.biz/mlaipodcast. As always, thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.